screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Goods, a film podcast. This is Brian, and here with me for episode 160 is Dan. How you doing, Dan?
Hey, Brian. It's almost springtime, and things are picking up both at home and at work, so I've been kind of busy, but I knew that I had to carve time out for this little gem of a film to discuss today.
Oh, good. Yes, it's been just over a week since we sat down the last time. For calendar context, the Willy's chocolate experience in Glasgow is sweeping the meme headlines these days. Did you keep tabs on that, Dan?
I did. I saw that. It was pretty funny. Sometimes I feel a little bit bad for the people involved. Like, it can come across as mean-spirited, I think, when they're just people doing stuff. But some of that stuff made me laugh pretty hard, too. It was pretty good.
Yeah, my sympathy dwindles when they fall for AI posters with nonsense words on them. But it's fostered some good memes, and it makes me want to start a convention, some Eventbrite event, because I know that it could have higher production values than that.
Yeah, it apparently isn't that hard if they're able to pull it off and get people there.
Yeah, but at the same time, I guess it wouldn't accrue the same notoriety. Like, all those actors are getting on talk shows now, so...
I actually just read today that they have already greenlit a film that is going to involve the unknown. I don't know if that's actually true, but it's a headline I saw, which is like the made-up villain character that was part of that Glasgow experience.
Goes to show that no publicity is bad publicity, at least if you get enough of it. Perhaps on that same subject, the movie that I've brought for us to discuss today is one that... reached a much broader audience due to negative word of mouth. We're still doing our debut month. It's been directors so far, so I'm ready to call it directorial debut month, but maybe you get some of the trick up your sleeve before next time. The film comes to us from 1966, and it is Manos, The Hands of Fate. The one and only film directed by Harold P. Warren. Maybe it invalidates some of your weekly questions, Dan, but I wanted the opportunity to talk about a movie where it was both their first as well as their only project.
Right. Like you said, sometimes your first is your last. You could have chosen like Night of the Hunter or something like that, but I guess you went the route of films that sometimes are listed as worst of all time instead of films that are sometimes listed as best of all time.
Right. We sat down not that long ago, within the past year, and we talked about The Room. We talked about Plan 9 from Outer Space. I thought this would be keeping good company with those.
What are the other bad movie mountains for us to climb, Brian? What's left for us?
I guess we could watch Birdemic. We haven't done Troll 2 yet, officially.
Oh, that's true.
But... we've covered things I never even knew about, like after last season, so I think we've attained decent coverage already. And maybe in some ways I'm afraid of what might lie ahead. My connection to this film, Manos, I actually discovered it around the same time as Troll 2, which was like 2006, sophomore year of high school. It was like, we watched Troll 2, and then we thought, okay, well, what else can we find? What else is out there? And my friend Ben got a double feature DVD of Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes. And the two on the disc, it was like the greatest hits, quote unquote, of Mystery Science Theater. The front headliner, first billing, was Manos, Hands of Fate. And then the B-side of the disc was Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. So, like, on one evening, we watched both of those. And both memorable, for sure. Both low-budget movies, I think both from the 60s. And with memorable, distinctive visuals. But I think Manos definitely takes the cake. That's the one that you gotta go tell people about. So much so that I made it my very first entry on my 100 film favorites, that being number 100, the first one I wrote about in 2013. It has subsequently fallen off the list. You'll notice it didn't get a shout out when we did our updated lists last year. But it left an imprint. A handprint, if you will. But yeah, I became aware of this movie through Mystery Science Theater. And I think this is kind of one of the deepest cuts that that show rescued from obscurity. We'll talk a little bit more about its origins. But I was so inspired that I made a Torgo costume pretty much right around the time that we first watched. And you'll get to know who Torgo is soon, if you don't already. Then, when I started my public access show, because this is a public domain movie, no one has rushed to claim its copyright.
And isn't it along the lines of Night of the Living Dead, where the issue is that they forgot to put a copyright symbol or something on a title card?
It could be, because, as I'm sure you noticed, there's this long, drawn-out stretch of footage of just a car driving through the desert, and you think there should be something here. Like, maybe there should be some opening titles and opening credits, and there's just nothing. So that could well be the cause. So when I started my public access TV show in 2013, pretty early on, I did a Manos episode, which was an excuse to make a costume of the other main male antagonist, the Master, who is the one who wears the cloak with the hands on it. So I've got a good, like, screen quality Torgo costume and Master costume.
Did you make those or did you buy them?
Made them.
Wow. Yeah, I've seen pictures of it. There's one in our episode notes. It looks good.
Join our Discord to get a closer look. Wore them in my public access show. And then subsequently, I've had a couple occasions, one of which was the Mystery Science Theater guys did a Riff Tracks live screening at one point. I think I've actually talked about it when we did The Room, maybe, that I went to this like movie theater event where they screened Manos, and I wore the Torgo costume, and then people were like lining up, oh, Torgo's here! Get pictures with Torgo!
I read an interesting thing. It might have been on the Wikipedia page or some article I found about the public domain usage of this. And it's not like whether you can screen it, but whether you can use it in subsidiary works. Because apparently the director, Harold P. Warren, he like trademarked or copyrighted the script, but not the movie, which is like not ever done really. So there's some question of like, well, to what extent is the movie itself, if since it's using the script manifest? And so since it has the script in it, you can't use it. And apparently those legal questions are as yet unresolved.
I've actually heard a couple cases like that. One is Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which the title card has incorrect copyright information, but CBS has got it pretty locked down because they've got the script, and especially they've got the soundtrack copyrighted. So it's like, you could maybe do an original sequel, which people have done, like use the characters, but you can't use that copyrighted script or that copyrighted soundtrack.
Gotcha.
Fortunately, perhaps, listeners, this movie is short. It's just barely over an hour long, which made it a good candidate for my public access show where I had to cram everything into an hour. Won't take too long to recap, but here, Dan, on the precipice, what were your thoughts going into this one? What did you know before you watched it, and what were you feeling when you sat down and popped the DVD in, or however you watched this thing?
I cracked my neck, I cracked my knuckles, and I said, I know I'm in for a bumpy ride here, but let's do it. No, I mean, all I knew about it was that it has a reputation for being just broken as a piece of cinema, and also that there's a weird guy, and that you have some affection for it. Those are really the three things that I knew about it. And it didn't really disappoint on any of those fronts, I would say.
A weird guy. It's a little generous. I'd say there may even be more than one weird guy, but there is one who stands head and shoulders above the rest. So the way that this movie came about was, at least the story goes, as the result of a bet. Harold P. Warren was a fertilizer salesman living in El Paso, Texas. Apparently he had a friend who was a scriptwriter or something, had a little more industry experience. And a la Dr. Seuss and, which one was it, Green Eggs and Ham? The scriptwriter was like, well, listen, man, it's harder to make a movie than you think. And Hal Warren said, nah, anybody can do it. Watch this. And lo and behold, this was the result. So he basically pulled in some people that he knew, didn't pay anybody a whole lot. It was like he gave the child actress a bike and gave the dog a sack of dog food. And rented a camera that, like, can only go 30 seconds at a stretch, like little strips of film, which limited the length that the takes could be. And also led to, like, not great continuity, because there's, like, jumps and things. Breaks, and then just a new thing will start.
I'm reminded of the Anton Ego quote in Ratatouille. Not everyone can become a great artist, but a great artist can come from anywhere. And this movie made me think of that, and which end of the two sides of that that you fall on, I think, is up for debate.
I feel like I don't know that movie as well as you do, but there's another branch of the discussion of that Ego quote where he's like, not everyone can cook, or something. When he's more critical, like before the turn at the end of the movie. He's like, no, not everyone can make a movie, or everyone can, but not everyone should. Oh, because it was Gusteau that said anyone can cook, and Anton did not agree with that. And then they like equivocate at the end.
Exactly. Yeah. And another relevant one that I sometimes think of is when Remy's the rat. I forget the name. Linguini, I think, the name of the human protagonist. He says something like, for someone who likes food, you sure are skinny. And then he says, I don't like food, I love it. And if it's not good, I don't swallow, or something like that. And sometimes I think about that myself, like, how pretentious do I need to be as a critic, as a movie consumer and thinker? Do I need to celebrate all trash or just some trash? Or is it above me to love trash? And I will tell you, it's not above me to love trash. I love plenty of trash. But just how deep do I go down? That's like a part of my soul I am still uncovering.
What movie do you pop in and it does the like dolly zoom where suddenly you're sitting in your childhood living room? Is it a Goofy movie? What is it?
It's a Goofy movie, 100%. I'm not even joking. If you go to my website, I almost want you to do this right now. Go to my website, thegoodsreviews.com, pull up a Goofy movie. The first sentence of the review is, when I watch this movie, I become Anton Ego in Ratatouille, where the dolly zoom, I don't say dolly zoom, when he takes a bite and he's brought back to his childhood. So,
oh, damn.
Good pull on that.
A psychic. Got the envelope to my forehead.
And actually, our friend over at Kinemalog, Hunter, he just published a terrific review of A Goofy Movie where he gave it a coveted 10 out of 10. So that was exciting for me too.
Solid film. Love the Goofy Movie.
A Goofy Movie.
Well, they've only done one. The other one was, what, an extremely goofy movie.
Yeah.
To me, a goofy movie is just a movie. A window into my dark and twisted world. Okay, but let's actually talk about what's in this thing. As we've set it up, first-time filmmakers, low-budget equipment, limited equipment, filming out in the El Paso desert. So when this movie opens, we've got, as mentioned, this sequence of this car just driving through the desert, and occasionally stopping, and they sing, row, row, row your boat. And then it'll start again. Drive some more. Drive, drive, drive. For like 7 minutes they drive. And there's this music playing. I like this stock soundtrack music that they have. Just because I wonder, like, what about those people? Who made those things? And was this the most prominent that they ever got?
We should look up the credits. Who composed this? Where did he source this? Presumably, there's something on it.
From the very first moment we hear a person talk, we can tell that all the audio has been dubbed in, all the dialogue, because they didn't have the capacity to record sync sound. And it's rough because it's just rough. One of the reasons is they dubbed the little girl with an adult woman. And so anytime she talks, she sounds like Gordy Ghostly from The Rescue of Pops Ghostly. They're like, where did you see the dog, Debbie? A big place. A big place? Yeah.
This movie is run-of-the-mill bad, just kind of boring and bad, until you get to literally anything about the sound design, at which point it's like a hydrogen bomb. It's or like a cataclysm, like a black hole. Like, there's no longer gravity, there's no longer mass or matter. It's just like everything comes into like one like singularity, and there is no good, there is no bad. It is just like something you've never seen before. It's got like this ASMR quality to it where you're like hearing the music and it's kind of lulling you to sleep, like it's a hypnotist on a flute, like something like that. And also, just the voices, they are just disconnected enough from the people that you're like, what the hell is going on? But also connected enough that you're like not losing track of the thread. And it sounds like nothing you've ever seen. And it is explosively funny whenever the little girl talks and like a woman's voice using falsetto comes out. It's like me narrating a picture book when I'm reading to my kids. And it's just, it's insane, man. It's like avant-garde deconstructed cinema. Like, I don't know, dude. This is something else.
This was one of the original Brian Terrell movie night selections pretty early on. Because, yeah, once you see it, you're compelled to talk about it.
As soon as the people started talking, I became that meme where, like, you sit up straight and your back arches and you're all of a sudden, like, locked in on what's going on. I was watching it by myself. I was looking around the room I was in. I was like, y'all seeing this shit? I was like, what is this? This is unlike anything I've ever seen.
Harold P. Warren pulls a Tommy Wiseau because he's in here playing the lead. A guy named Michael, who's the father of this family. It's him and his wife and his daughter driving this convertible through the desert. And they've got to stop for the night because even though it seems like it's broad daylight, you never can tell in these things. Like Plan 9, time is kind of subjective. And so they take this detour. They go off on a side road following a sign pointing to the Valley Lodge. And at one point they pass this couple making out in a car who their whole role in this movie is to just constantly be sitting by the side of various roads making out. I read that this is because Warren hired a bunch of models to be in the movie. And then this model broke her foot, so she couldn't do any of the choreography later on, but he wasn't going to let a model go to waste. So he said, all right, you sit here and you make out, and that'll be your contribution to the film.
One vibe I got from this movie is that he wanted to make it like a light PG softcore titillation thing. There's a lot with like, the extended making out scenes and then some stuff we're going to get to. It was like, is he trying to be like erotic here or something? He being the director.
It's definitely some kind of softcore.
Yeah. Like three softs at least, I think.
Yeah. It's like something sexy is happening in another room. But it's also, this watch had me thinking of, have you seen that meme of, on tonight's episode, the writer's barely disguised fetish?
I have not. What do you think is his fetish here then?
Well, we'll get there. I think cat fighting is part of it. But maybe like the specific outfits. Yeah. Like, and also the whole cult structure. One guy with a lot of women. I think there's a lot that's fetishistic here. Anyhow, the car veers off. They're going to the Valley Lodge. Got to stay for the night. And they're out in the middle of the desert. By the way, Dan, I think this movie inspired Hotel California by the Eagles. Like, listen to the lyrics of Hotel California and tell me it's not about Manos, the Hands of Fate.
Does the timeline match up? Could they have seen this in a cheap theater?
Yeah, this is, you know, this was 1966, and Hotel California was later than that, but I will get a year. 1977.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to make Hotel California the movie, it would have many, many of the plot beats that are in this film.
Relax, said the night man, I am programmed to receive. As Torgo greets them when they pull up to the front door of the Valley Lodge, and this guy comes shambling out. So who is Torgo, Dan?
Would that we could answer that question in a mere podcast, Brian. He's, well, first of all, he's dressed in, like, the director said, hey, bring some shabby clothes to when we're filming today. And what he came with was, like, an over-loose shirt and gray jacket and brown pants. And then he's got a hat that looks, you don't see hats like this too often anymore. It's kind of wide-brimmed. It's a little bit like an Indiana Jones hat, but not quite that.
Yeah, I think of it like a Freddy Krueger hat.
Okay.
It's like a bigger brim a little bit.
Yeah.
And he also has these enormous knees. Really, really big knees. Like, he's got basketballs in his pants.
Do you think they're, like, swollen? Like, how does that happen? Is that just part of, did he stuff it with something to make it look like he's a hunchback?
It's definitely stuffed with something. And one of the theories that I've read is that he's supposed to be some kind of satyr. And perhaps put the knees on backwards. Like, they're supposed to make it look like he's got backwards knees, like a goat man.
It's just a horrible execution of that concept.
Right, it's just very odd looking.
Interesting.
And they probably play a role in why he walks so strangely. But there could be other contributing factors, too. Because I'll bet this guy was involved in the 60s drug scene. He seems like he's not all there. And he sounds like nothing you've heard before. So now the two titans of this movie meet each other, Michael and Torgo. And they're sizing each other up. And Torgo says, I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
Do you think it's the best voice on the goods since Jason Funderburker, Brian?
Hey, Sarah. Oh, it's up there. For sure. At least in terms of ones you want to immediately attempt to do. And Torgo is just never steady on his feet. He's always rocking back and forth and, like, getting a little out of focus. And just his eyes are, like, glazed over. He has a staff with a hand on the end of it, which is the first hint of the hand motif we're going to see in this film.
It's funny you mentioned that he might be, like, a burnout. Because this whole movie, if I were to describe it, it's like what I imagine getting head trauma feels like. There's like a semi-relationship with reality and then like this droning music that just doesn't go away. And like you're never quite sure where and when you are.
What I've noticed more and more as I watch this, and this is probably like the seventh or eighth time I've seen this movie, but it gets slower and slower. Like other movies I watch, like the old Disney movies, they seem like they're over in the blink of an eye. It's like, this is so short. So much happens and it's only like 80 minutes long. Manos is shorter than that and it just seems interminable.
Again, it's like a black hole. It's like it distorts the time-space continuum when you start watching Manos.
And the way the dialogue is strange, too. Not just that it's dubbed over, but also, like, every line is said twice. There's a lot of, like, parrot speak in a way that I've not seen in another movie. Like, it will be dark soon. There is no way out of here. It will be dark soon.
Tommy Wiseau might not have realized it, but this movie was his great forebear.
Torgo keeps saying the master wouldn't approve of the family staying at the night at this hotel. I mean, I guess it's a hotel. It had a sign pointing to it that said Valley Lodge, but Torgo doesn't act like people normally stay there. He just talks like it's somebody's house. So, unusual.
Yeah.
But Michael is very insistent and says, we need to stay here tonight. Even though Torgo's like, you shouldn't do that. And his wife says, you shouldn't do this. Michael says, we're going to do this. And one gets the sense that that was his energy for this whole project. Harold P. Warren just saying, no, we're pressing on. We're doing it my way. Get in front of the camera and shut up.
I don't know if it's fair to say that Torgo just says, you shouldn't do this. He, like, writhes like a slug up to him and pokes him with his long Manos hand and says, what are you doing? You shouldn't stay here and stuff like that. It's I don't know. It's something else.
I will say, anytime Torgo moves, the movie gets better. One reason is it plays this music whenever he's walking around that goes boop 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 boop, like a four note on a keyboard.
If a music played whenever you walked, Brian, what music would play?
Oh man. Do you have an answer for that?
Yes. Toss up between the last minute of Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. That would be like if I'm walking dramatically. And if I'm walking like playfully, it would be the opening minute of Lust for Life by Iggy Pop.
Wow.
If I remember, I'll drop both of those in the Discord too. You can join the Discord at thegoodsfilmpodcast.com. And we hang out there and we drop media there as well.
Well, you came prepared. I'm going to select Nothing Gonna Break My Stride. I think that's a good walking song.
Okay.
So, reluctantly, Torgo carries their bags inside. And I love the moment when the husband and the wife are talking, just standing in the lobby, the parlor of this place, and like looking around saying, oh, this is kind of menacing. Something's wrong. This is a bad place. And then Torgo walks up between them and just lurches across the room carrying the bag. And it's like a rim shot on a drum set. Just the comic timing of the doot, 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 as he plows through between them, walking his way across the room.
Anything that happens to them, they deserve at this point. Like, you could literally pull your car off to the side of the road, and it would be safer and more comfortable than what you're going through here. Why does he want to stay here? I don't know.
It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre if Leatherface gave them 5 opportunities to leave.
And like told you, you really shouldn't stay here. The people who are here like want you dead and stuff. So like,
we're going to wear your faces.
You might want to think about it.
It's like those waivers that say you will be recorded on the premises. It's like you will be killed here. Just so you know, your presence is acknowledgement and consent. But they start settling in for the night. And gradually we're kind of introduced to the other characters who are here at the lodge. A lot of this movie meanders and repeats, and the pacing is molassesy. It's just glacial. Like, things don't progress quickly. But the big things, that's what we want to tell you about, the key elements, and one of those is the master, who is the leader of this compound, but he's in like suspended animation in this space, which I can't tell if it's a room of the house or if it's just out in the desert outside. The layout of the house is a little unclear to me, but he like sleeps on a slab and he's surrounded by his wives. He's got 6 wives who are also in this frozen slumber, except they are on like Joan of Arc pyres is where they sleep, and he's on like the stone slab that we saw in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And Torgo is the only one who spends the day awake and like goes around dusting their bodies for cobwebs while they're in this suspended animation, I guess. Is there anything about the experience that I'm not conveying, Dan?
I mean, I think you saying that it has a sort of glacial pace is key. There's like two total incidents in the entire film. Like they get there and then I guess eventually like the main character gets knocked out. Like that's really the two things that happen in this movie before the final shot. And there's like just kind of connective tissue. It's nothing but connective tissue and waiting. And what it actually had me thinking of is it's almost like David Lynch-esque dream logic, surreality, where like the fact that the voices are off adds to the sense that we're in a dark dream, like the same way a dream sometimes goes nowhere and then you're abruptly somewhere else and like the space doesn't fit together. And even there's like a shot or two of Torgo like lurching towards the camera that had me thinking of the old people in Mulholland Drive at towards the end when they lurch towards the camera. There's something about it that it's like incompetence crossed through the threshold. It like broke through the veil and we're like into avant-garde absurdism that is like, how did they come up with this? What's going to happen next? I have no idea. We've broken all rules of narrative film texture. Like what's happening?
I want to hear this now with a David Lynch score swapped in underneath it.
I mean,
it's not too different, but just the sense that the way that I, and again, I've not seen too many David Lynch movies, but a lot of them have this quality where the soundtrack is menacing, even if nothing specifically menacing is happening on screen. It's like, oh, something is wrong here.
But see, that's kind of how I would describe the score here, is because the way it weirdly toggles on and off and it's got this droning, jazzy almost quality to it, you're like, something is off here. Like what? Yeah, I actually feel kind of the same way. Like if it weren't so obscure until the 80s or whenever the MST3K episode came on, I would say like, is this a kind of movie that David Lynch watched 100 times when he was a kid? And he's like, there's a kernel here of something that I want to replicate, but not through incompetence.
Right. Oh, kind of like the way that Tim Burton treated Ed Wood.
Right.
At some point, the master's dog kills the family's dog. They have like this little poodle, and the poodle's name is Pepe. I don't know the name of the big demon dog. But then we get to hear the dubbed over daughter saying, "Where's Pepe? Where's Pepe?"
Now, what I really want to hear is Brian doing all the voices, like a Brian vocal track for this movie.
Speaking of vocal tracks, this movie is available with different audio tracks, at least, because it's like, in a sense, you almost need the MST3K commentary to fill in some of the gaps. At least if that's the way that you saw it first. There's like beats from that. And not that it's always funny. I don't know. I sometimes think the commentary in that is just kind of a distraction. But sometimes it's funny. And there are definitely like jokes that they make that I think about while I watch this film.
Yeah, I found a copy of this movie on like a gray market film streaming area. And I started watching it. I got about a minute in and it might have been Riff Tracks. I don't think it was MST3K, but there was commentary going on over it. I was like, no, I don't want to watch it this way. I want to watch it pure. I want to inject it right into my veins. And I found it's on Tubi. Actually, there's like five copies on Tubi. Most of them have some track over them, but there is the original that doesn't have anything over it. And it actually looked pretty clean. I think it must have been the remaster. Have we talked about that yet, Brian?
Not yet, but let's do it now. So I love this story. When I wrote my post about Manos back in 2013 to kick off my review series, this was like brand spanking new news. So from 1966, when this movie came out and did not see very wide release, and then there were like copy of a copy prints being passed around, and eventually one found its way into the hands of the Mystery Science Theater producers. So like by that point, it was already, the quality had degraded, what quality there was to begin with. But then in 2011, somebody working in an old movie theater, like in the Texas desert, found in the back room an original pristine work print of Manos, The Hands of Fate. So for like 50 years, 45 years, this thing had been sitting in the back room, now unearthed, just orders of magnitude better than what we had. It's like a milestone of almost lost cinema that they found this thing and were able to make a remastered Manos Blu-ray. It's just such an alien experience to look at it now and see like the vibrant colors and the shining eyes of these people. It makes them much more alive than they were before. And you're just struck by the fact that, oh, real people had to do this thing.
It's like this and Carl Theodore Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc, like the movies that God intended for people to see. Like it was considered lost, and then a beautiful, pristine copy was found in a closet somewhere. And the heavens rejoiced because now we could hear God's word.
And this was my first time actually watching the remastered version, so a little bit different from what I'd seen before, and the colors really pop. The focus still is not always there. And I mean, you're polishing a turd. It's like, it still is what it's always been, but all the same, it's an amazing story of film preservation.
There is some weird visual stuff going on here as you go through it. I mean, first of all, the camera placement and the direction is just baffling. You're like, why are we looking at it from this angle? Why are we zoomed in on Torgo right now? Why is one of the wives taking up half the screen and then like there's this weird black splotch in the other half of the screen, so that you like almost think that it's artistic, but it's not quite right. And then I think they just shot it at night and like everything looks dark and desaturated, which normally you are more intentional on those things. And here, if you just shoot it at night, like weird bits look really dark and it actually looks kind of haunting. And like, I don't know, not what I typically expect a movie to look like, where there's just big black patches on the screen. And I was almost impressed. I was like, it's kind of like not artistic, but so ugly and so like striking that it circles back into interesting, at least.
Yeah. One element I actually like is the production design, because they really lean into this hand motif that the cult has. Pretty soon, the master and the wives wake up. I guess some stuff does happen before that, but their whole deal is they worship this deity called Manos. Not Manun, but Manos.
Oh, man. Now that would have bumped up the craft if it had been about Manos instead of Manon.
And Manos, obviously the Spanish word for hands. And I don't know what Manos's deal is any more than Manon, except he loves hands. Put hands on everything. Put hands on your clothes. Incorporate hands in any art that you make. Have like hand-shaped altars and hand-shaped cave paintings.
That one painting that we see a few times is actually pretty damn cool. It's like the master with his dog, but the dog's eyes are just like pricks of light, and it's got like an oil painting texture to it. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I wonder where that ended up. And if you're going to make a prop for your movie, that's a good one to make, because the family sees the painting long before they ever see the master, and they take time to pontificate of, oh, he must be a bad dude. Also, before the master wakes up, Torgo is creeping around, just creeping on everybody. So Torgo has designs on the wife, the mom of the family. But apparently the master wants her too. And as I mentioned, the Master's got a bunch of wives in this hypersleep in his chamber. And Torgo has apparently been assigned, okay, recruit the wife. Or abduct the wife. Just get her in here, make her a frozen wife. Bride of the Master. But this sows the seeds of discord in their happy little commune, because Torgo says, no, Master, you've already got six wives. I should get this one. I've got dibs on number seven. I like when Torgo makes his move on the mom, because he very slowly moves up to her and reaches out his, like, shuddering goat man hand and touches her hair. And she recoils.
And I think it's either just before that or just after that, when she's, like, getting dressed. Of course, it's, like, never even close to actual nudity, because this is light PG straight through. But it's genuinely one of the most unsettling things I've seen in months, where he, like, looks in the window with, like, the thirstiest, creepiest look on his face. Torgo looking after the wife character.
The tender peeping Torgo scene is what they say in Mystery Science Theater. And I guess prior to this, Torgo, like, the way that he gets his kicks is hanging out in the wife chamber and, like, doing unspoken things among the frozen women. And when the Master wakes up, he's like, Torgo, hypersleep doesn't make them blind, doesn't make them deaf. You can't do creepy shit in the frozen chamber, Torgo. You gotta stop.
How many times have you been told that, Brian? No, I'm just kidding.
No, but I get a lot of the recoiling when I reach for the hair. But now they're all awake in the chamber. I don't exactly know what triggers that, why they're asleep at the start and then suddenly they're up and moving around. But there's this funny, like, smash cut where the Master wakes up the wives and then it, like, cuts. And the next shot, all the wives are fighting with each other. They're all bickering and arguing. And you just get this, like, 1,000-yard stare on the Master's face. Like, what have I done?
Yeah, this made me laugh out loud. It's a little bit of like a, it's almost like a Rodney Dangerfield, like, women, am I right, type joke.
boomer humor.
As soon as they wake up, they're slapping each other.
Take my wife, please. Take my six cult wives, please.
There's a visual grace to these catfight scenes where they're like these women in these long flowing robes. Clearly no planned choreography in the wrestling, like, just trying to figure out how they're going to throw each other down to the sand. Also, where are we geographically? I guess we're in, like, the backyard or something like that. Not clear.
Yeah, really hard to tell if this is somehow inside the house, like a courtyard, or if it's just out in the desert. But of the 80-minute runtime, I would say, like, almost 20 minutes of it is these women in long nightgowns slapping each other.
That's what it feels like.
Rolling around in the sand.
Yeah.
Let's see. I want to make sure that if there's nuggets here, I pick them out. But, anytime Torgo says something, the way that it's said is interesting and memorable. Like, there is no phone here. The Master wouldn't approve of such devices.
If you're still staying at a place when someone says that to you, you got what's coming to you. I'm sorry. That was like your fifth and final chance to bail.
Or, there's a phone at the crossroads. That's 10 miles.
Another thing I liked is the Master. First of all, he's got this intense stare at the screen. That's just great, man. It's really good. And then he also does not at all convey as, like, a timeless being, because he's got, like, a 1970s Doobie Brothers mustache, and he just looks like someone that you would see playing guitar at a church service, like, playing folk tunes. It's like, it made me laugh the way that this dude looks.
Yeah, he looks a little like Frank Zappa, but, like, more so a dad that you might see on the street.
Right.
Just somebody's dad who's wearing a poncho. But whenever he flares the poncho out, you get to see the big red hands embroidered on the wings of the cloak, and it looks really cool. I like it.
Yeah, unironically cool design when you get to see that.
Also, whenever he invokes Manos and makes these big Manos sermons, the dialogue is like actually, well, it's thought out. I don't know if it's good, but it sounds ponderous. He's like, Manos, thy will be done.
Brian's holding his hands up in the air. Hallelujah. Take me to church, master.
Sign me up. Polygamy? Okay. Meanwhile, like, this whole story, as the night's going on, it keeps cutting to the side of the road where this teen couple is just always making out in their car. And I guess the purpose it serves beyond the beginning of the movie is that the police are, like, constantly shooing them away to say, hey, stop that. This is the 60s, and you can't have public display of affection. It's like, move on, to show, I guess, what the cops are doing all night instead of rescuing hapless travelers.
I think also to, like, try and add a little more of, like, the, oh, I'm trying to be sort of exploitative with some sexiness, but, like, it's just two people making out in a car, fully clothed, at a medium shot distance. It's like got no sexual energy to it. But it also has the cadence of like an anti-joke of like a Sideshow Bob stepping on a rake.
Or the chicken fight in Family Guy.
Right. And another thing it made me think of, I don't know why I made this connection, but in Love Actually, when there's the one character who wants to go to America and you keep being like, okay, at some point, this is going to have a point. There's going to be, like, something that disrupts it or something that's learned. But it just literally happens as it says it's going to happen at the very beginning of the movie. And there's no, like, development or innovation in it. And I think there it's played explicitly as an anti-joke. Here, it's just got the cadence of an anti-joke. Because they couldn't think of what to do with it.
For a long time, the wives argue about, like, what are they going to do to the family? Like, they're all pretty much on board with inducting the wife into their coven. But, like, does that mean they have to kill the daughter? Does that mean they kill the dude? They seem pretty much in agreement. Okay, well, we'll kill the dude. But there's a lot of back and forth. It sounded like they, like, looped the wife audio. So there's, like, layers of, like, the same people talking over themselves. Very alien. At some point, Michael ends up out in the desert, and he's like, maybe he's going for help, but Torgo sneaks up on him and whacks him on the head, and then he's unconscious for a while. He might be tied up at some point. There's just, like, wandering around, and time is just dripping away from your life. But I guess, what's the climax here? Eventually, like, Michael goes in to confront the master, and then time just, like, stops. Well, I guess that's... So that's the climax, ostensibly. What else happens before then? One thing is the master gets fed up with Torgo's insolence, and he expels Torgo from the home. He says, "You have failed us, Torgo." And he thrusts Torgo's hand into a fire. And, like, the hand detaches and is all on fire. And that effect is kind of disturbing and cool.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, hold on. They're trying something here. That's not just, like, people walking around a room or women wrestling each other into the sand. A burnt hand.
So Torgo runs off into the desert, holding his flaming stump over his head. But then, yeah. Finally, Michael steps up to face the master back in the house. And time, like, stops. And Michael fires this pistol that he's been carrying around the whole time. And the bullets, like, dissolve. Or they go through the master or around him. And everything kind of, like, goes out of focus, and all you can tell is that the master's glaring at them.
This is another moment that had me thinking a little bit of David Lynch, because it's like in Mulholland Drive, right when it's shifting from one reality to another reality, and that existence breaks down, cinematic reality breaks down.
Great pull, because then when we come back, things are kind of shuffled around, characters in new roles.
One thing before we get to the final scene here, the final big reveals, is there's a bit in the climax where, you know, they're trying to run from the house, but they can't escape, whatever, where the cops come, and the cops are like looking in the dark. They're like, you heard them. They have this hilariously insipid dialogue about, well, sound can travel far. For all we know, it's in Mexico. But I tell you, if they had like shined their light and turned it on and the makeout couple was there, I would have bumped this movie up an extra point. It would have been the funniest thing I'd ever seen. Oh, great. It would have been a perfect payoff on the joke. I think it needed the makeout couple needed just one more surprise appearance for it to really pay off.
Oh, wow. Maybe you should edit a special edition of the movie. What it should have been. There have been like a lot of re-releases and fan film sequels and follow-ups and things to this.
I did watch one. I want to talk about that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I have not. So I was wondering if you might.
Another thing is there's like a snake jump scare at one point. Like all of a sudden there's a snake in the desert and they freak out about it. But I don't know. It certainly doesn't feel like it's the same footage. Like he bought some stock footage of a snake, or I don't know exactly.
Absolutely. It cuts away. There's a snake. Cuts back. He's firing the gun. Cut back. The snake slithers away. So that's something you see a lot in these old B movies. Like we saw a little bit in Ed Wood's films, Plan 9. And someday I'm going to make you watch Lost Skeleton of Cadavera, which uses that as a gag several times.
Yeah, that sounds funny.
But after this dissolve of the master apparently being impervious to the bullets, we get a scene that's like a repeat of the opening scene with this convertible driving through the desert. Only now I think it's raining. So it's a little different because before, I guess, night was coming on and now it's raining. So they actually like put the top up. And it's like this Thelma and Louise couple of women, and they are looking for a place to stay. So they pull off at the Valley Lodge. Only who should appear on the porch? Because we know that Torgo got fired. Well, it's Michael, guys. Michael has been made into the manservant.
New Torgo. Torgo 2.0.
And he says, I am Michael. I take care of the place while the master is away. Then it dissolves again, and we see that the master has some new brides. Not just the wife, but also the like 7-year-old daughter is in one of these nightgowns.
Genuinely creepy and unsettling.
Very upsetting.
I think we do get another shot of the makeout couple towards the end, though, now that I'm thinking about it.
I think they see the Thelma and Louise pass by. So they're really committed to sitting by the side of the road. It's just what they do day to day.
Well, and when we see the new brides, well, we see all the brides again. It's shot in that same darkness where like half the space is black. So you're like not even sure what reality you're in. It's just so unusual.
And that's Manos, The Hands of Fate from 1966, Harold P. Warren. We did it.
We made it through.
It ended eventually.
It's like an Interstellar when you go into the black hole and you're like banging on the window. No, don't do that. And like time completely stops down, or it's like how 30 years pass in what should be an instant.
Yeah, the other planet where yeah, every minute here is a year on Earth.
Every minute on Manos is a year on Earth. Can I talk about the follow-up thing that I watched?
Please.
So I mentioned I ended up watching this on Tubi, and Tubi autoplays after one movie finishes to the next movie, at least on my app it did. And it did Manos Returns, which I had heard about. And so when it started playing, I was like, oh, well, it's only 67 minutes. I'll at least see what it is. So this is actually pretty interesting. The actress who played the kid, the 7-year-old, in the original movie, I guess she goes to like fan cons and stuff and keeps in touch with the people who were in the movie, which kind of makes sense because it was drawn from like an actual community of a theater troupe. So they had some established relationships, you know?
Right. And within the cast, there were some relationships because Jackie Naiman was the daughter who played Debbie, and her father, Tom Naiman, played the master. So both of them, I think, are involved at least in one of these projects, I thought.
Yeah. So it's, I think you said Jackie is the name of the younger one. So I think she like organized it, and they had multiple people from the original cast reappear. So yeah, the master reappears, and then she reappears. And then I think the mom even reappears in a role, the wife character.
No Torgo, though. John Reynolds committed suicide like right after this movie came out. So his singular film appearance.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah, actually. And then what was the name of the Naiman, the one who played the master?
I think it's Tom Naiman.
Yeah, he died in between the filming of Manos Returns and the release of it. So the credits say in his honor. But it's like close to unwatchable, unfortunately. It's very not good. I don't want to dump on people who like made a thing because it was a labor of love and they wanted to bring it back and like, oh, it's like hanging out with your old friends. But it's more like a reunion than an actual movie. And it's got in the second half, they do a little bit of interesting stuff with the lens, like the effects. They have some digital editing in there to make it give it like some creepy effects and stuff. But it didn't give me anything to latch on to. And I would only recommend it if you were like so obsessed with Manos that you find the intrinsic idea of seeing the cast again 50 years later or however many years later, pretty close to 50. Yeah. In a Manos, it's basically a very similar story. And it pulls in like a lot of gags. Like there's a making out couple. Yeah, that was the one extracurricular Manos related thing. I did not watch the Mystery Science Theater episode. I would like to at some point because it sounds like that's kind of a core pillar of the Manos and legacy. So, yeah.
But the fan project that I would emphatically recommend you track down is the Manos The Hands of Fate video game. So this was a project made, I got it on my iPad. I had it on my old iPad. It's not on my current one, and I couldn't find it on the App Store. It looks like you can get it on Steam, though. It's from the developer Freak Zone Games, and I love this project because it's a really dedicated tribute. It's got like every location, every major set piece of Manos, which granted is not much. So they expand it a bit. It's like they got the key scenes and you're playing broadly the plot of the film where you're Michael and you're trying to make it through the night and save the family. But each level has got a boss, and the boss as well as the enemies are taken from various Z-grade movies, like well-known schlock movies. And so one of the bosses is the robot monster, and one is the giant claw, and there are some goblin enemies from Troll 2, and there's like the killer shrews and the eye creatures. So lots of little references, and actually it's fun. It doesn't take very long to play. And then the final boss, you're up against the master, and it's like if you didn't get all the hands of fate as you made your way through the levels, then it plays out in the ending like it did in the movie where Michael becomes the new Torgo. But if in every level you got the hand of fate, you get the real good ending where the master is actually destroyed.
Wow.
So pretty well done. I recommend it. And I'm glad to see that you can get it on Steam because I was a little worried when I couldn't find it on the App Store anymore.
Yeah, I might go look it up then. That sounds pretty fun.
All right. Anything else? Any other business before we put a lid on this one and declare if it's good?
I don't think so. I think I'm ready to go.
Oh, no way. On Steam, it calls this the director's cut, and it looks like they added a Plan 9 level.
Ugh.
That wasn't even in it before.
Game changer.
I'm seeing Vampyra and Tor Johnson in this. Oh, man. I gotta download it again.
Just when I think I'm done, they pull me back in. You can never escape the hands of fate, Brian.
There is no way out of here.
Is it good is our signature section where we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale ranging from very not good, which is a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. So I will answer, is Manos, The Hands of Fate from 1966 good first? And I want to start by reminding listeners my philosophy on so bad as good movies, which is to say, I think that if a movie manages to inspire genuine reaction and enjoyment out of you, it may not be a success on like the typical parameters of how we call a movie good or bad, but like it's still good then. It's like good art because it's pushing against the norm and making you think about how weird it is that this is quote unquote bad, but still like watchable or interesting. And I don't think every so bad it's good movie is actually good. I think some movies are just bad and people, I don't know, I think it can get mean if you're just like, oh, I like watching this thing that's bad. Like, to me, there has to be something about it that actually draws you in. So Troll 2 has that in spades. The Room has that, although The Room also has some just ineptitude in it, and it goes on too long. This very much has it, too. And I think I would put it one tier below Troll 2 and one tier above The Room in terms of, like, how much just blissful, weird joy I got out of every strange twist in this. And like, it's just bizarre qualities in addition to what is clearly like ineptitude on a craft experience level, like doing things you're supposed to do, making a movie. I'm going to give this one a good and a recommendation that if you like quote unquote so good they're bad movies, This is a lock. This is a must watch. And the fact that it's only like 70 minutes or less, you know, you're right that like so little happens that even then it feels like a just drag, and like the whole pace of it. It's not just how little there is, but like something about the way it's put together with the droning score and like the hypnotic quality makes it feel like you're being lulled to sleep as you watch it. But I think this is absolutely worth a watch. And I don't know if I'll like it if I watch it again, but I would absolutely be open to watching it again.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you took it to heart, that you embraced it. It's absolutely memorable. I think I'm going to land on a 2, which actually I came in planning to give it a 1. A lot of things that I've assigned, I've thrown a 1 on. But just by the sheer power of how memorable Torgo is and the Master's hand cape, and the way the sound is done, and even just the story of how it was resurrected, how the work print was found, I think all those things play into a slightly higher rating for me. That said, it's a slog. It moves so slowly. This is one that when I showed it to people, they didn't immediately embrace it the way they did Troll 2. They're like, "What? Why are we doing this? It's moving so slow." It's cosplayable. It made me want to dress as Torgo. Channel Torgo. At least in the wardrobe department. It made me want more hand staffs in my life. And hand cloaks. And actually, the Manos hand cloak shows up in Gravity Falls. There's a character called the Hand Witch who wears the Manos cloak.
Oh, nice.
So I'm glad that you watched it. But like I said, 2 for me.
Maybe I was just like captive audience staring at it, but I mean, I guess I could see how you would be like, "What? Why are we doing this?" In a way that some of, like, Troll 2 isn't quite that incompetent, you know. Like, it's for all the reputation for a bad movie, the people who made it know how to make a movie, which is not true of this. And just the dubbing of the voices and the drowning in the score definitely makes it feel like you're just kind of not in a normal movie, the way that other bad movies don't feel that way, you know?
Not enough horror movies have a constant droning of jazz flute.
More should.
Yeah, not an instrument you expect to be unsettling, but if it's all the time when you don't expect one, it's like, what? What is happening? All right. I'm happy. I'm glad that we watch Manos, The Hands of Fate. What will we be watching next, Dan?
So to close out debut month, Brian, The film we are watching is a directorial debut, but it's more than that, Brian. It is the debut of a titan of a studio, of even you could say it is the debut of a medium, and it's the debut of a line that still exists today. And I'm referring to Walt Disney Animation Studios, the first Walt Disney Animation Studio movie, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And the supervising director of this is actually not Walt Disney, as you might hear if you ask someone off the street who directed Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He produced it, of course. But the supervising director is named David Hand, who is an influential American animator. And I'm not like a super duper animation head the way that some people are, like knowing, oh, this character was supervised by this director and this sequence was supervised by this director and this animator had this style of strokes and character designs. Like, I'm not quite that deep on it, but I might do a little bit of reading on it. But Brian, also, if you're up for it, I would like to use this as a chance to do a top five as well. And that is top five Walt Disney Animation Studio films. One's officially in the WDAS line, which excludes, for example, a Goofy movie. But most of the ones when you think of Disney movies are Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs as the final week, the final entry in debut month, Brian.
All right. Well, maybe this is finally my excuse to watch Home on the Range or Fun and Fancy Free.
Yeah. I'm definitely not going to have seen all of them by the time we get there, but I think it will be, we can talk about what percentage we've seen.
Okay. Sounds good. This has been fun. Looking forward to the next one. And thank you, listeners, for joining us here on The Goods.
Bye, Brian.